Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Francine Foss. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center, and he's an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology, and she's an expert in the treatment of lymphomas. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Francine welcome Dr. Peter Schwartz. Dr. Schwartz is the John Slade Eli Professor of Obstetrics, Gynecology, and Reproductive Sciences at Yale, and Dr. Schwartz is internationally recognized for his work regarding cervical and ovarian cancers.
Peter, thanks so much for being with us on the show this evening.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And maybe we can just start off by defining what is cervical cancer.
Well, cervical cancer is cancer that starts in the neck of the uterus. The uterus, for those who may not be familiar with anatomy, kind of looks like a pear or a light bulb. And the narrow end, the part that has the threads on the light bulb or where the stem comes out of the pear, that's the cervix. Worldwide, cervical cancer is the second most common cancer women get in the world. And here in the United States, though, it's only the 13th most common cancer. So that's because our Pap smear screening program works, whereas in the underdeveloped world, we don't have very effective screening for cervical cancer.
Peter, can you tell us what age women get cervical cancer and who's really at risk for it?
Okay. Women who are at risk for cervical cancer are women who have been exposed to the human papillomavirus. And the factors that usually are associated with that are early age of first intercourse, multiple partners. And in the past, we used to talk about children delivered before age 18. But clearly, the human papillomavirus is what is involved with the etiology of cervical cancer worldwide. Now, we should be careful when we talk about cervical cancer, we're talking about invasive cancer. Invasive cancer can spread and kill patients, but many, many more women get precancerous changes, and those are the changes that we detect with the Pap smear. Those are the changes that we can cure by treatment in the office or with some simple surgical procedures, and we can preserve fertility. Invasive cancer of the cervix occurs mainly in women between age 40 and 50 here in the United States, and that is the disease that the Pap smear screening has dramatically reduced.
Now, Peter, other than the human papillomavirus, are there any other risk factors that one needs to be concerned about?
Yeah, smoking has been a cofactor associated with cervical cancer, and alcohol consumption has also been associated with cervical cancer. But the predominant factor associated with cervical cancer and the precancerous changes are human papillomavirus infection.
Peter, can you tell us a little bit about human papillomavirus? How is it spread?
Okay. Human papillomavirus is a very interesting virus because it has a predilection for the anogenital area, that is the skin around the opening of the vagina as well as around the anus, and also for the mucous membranes, that's the lining of the vagina, the cervix, but also it involves, as you well know, the upper airways as well and the digestive system. So the anogenital human papillomavirus that we're concerned about is spread predominantly through intercourse.
And obviously there's been a great deal of publicity surrounding the development of a vaccine for the human papillomavirus. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. There is now one vaccine approved in the United States, but there are two vaccines that have been used worldwide. What we've recognized is that the most common types of human papillomavirus associated with invasive cancer of the cervix are types 16 and types 18. But we've also recognized that for warts that appear in the genital and the anal area, as well as cancers of the vagina and precancerous changes of the vagina, the vulva, and the anus, type 6 and type 11 are also associated with it. One of the vaccines, the type that's approved here in the United States is called Gardasil, and that one covers both 6 and 11 as well as 16 and 18. A second virus, which is used really worldwide, is not yet approved in the United States. It only covers 16 and 18.
And again, when should the vaccinations be administered?
Well, the vaccine is approved for women ages 9 to 26, but usually we still think about age 11 or so as the time when young girls should be vaccinated. At this moment, it is only approved for women. It is not approved yet for men or for boys, although this seems to be in the works.
So, Peter, can you clarify for our listeners, if a person already has a positive human papillomavirus on their pap smear, for instance, would they be a candidate for this vaccine, or is this only a preventive vaccine?
This is a preventive vaccine. There's basically two types of vaccines. There's the therapeutic vaccine, which would be used to treat a process, and the therapeutic vaccine, which is what the Gardasil is used to prevent the process, the infection, from developing. Now, the vaccine is approved for women who have not been exposed to HPV, but there's always issues. If, my goodness, I have a precancerous change, perhaps I have type 16 and not type 18, can I benefit by being given the Gardasil? We really don't have a lot of data on that, but it's something that could be still considered.
And are there any potential side effects, complications resulting from the vaccine?
Anytime you administer the vaccine, there's always local irritation. There can be pain, some burning sensation, some itching in that area. There have been very few systemic problems that have been reported with the vaccine. There has been a rare case of asthma and a case of bronchospasm. But in terms of mortality, which is what we always worry about, the mortality rates for the young women who have received the vaccine are no different than control groups.
So, Peter, given the risk of cervical cancer and the prevalence of HPV in the population, do you feel that this vaccine should become part of the regular immunization profile for our children?
Absolutely. This has been the single most dramatic development in my 30-odd years as a gynecologic oncologist. The idea that a vaccine can be given to prevent what is really horrendous cancer, should that develop, it just blows my mind. I really recommend it for my own grandnieces now, and I certainly think it's appropriate for all young women.
Great. Peter, maybe we can talk a little bit about the current methods approved for screening for cervical cancer.
Sure. The pap smear has been extremely effective in reducing the incidence rates of cervical cancer in the United States. They were introduced here in Connecticut in 1957 or so. We now expect only 120 cases a year of cervical cancer in Connecticut. In the United States as a whole, only 11,000 new cases of cervical cancer. When I went to medical school, it was the number one cancer in women. Today, it's number 13. Pap smear screening really works. There have been some developments, however, in pap smear screening, including the development of liquid-based cytology, which initially was supposed to be more effective than the conventional cytology that women have been getting for many years. More recent studies suggest it's as effective as the conventional. So it's getting the pap smear that's critical, not the type that you get. Even more recently, however, has been HPV screening. And HPV screening allows us to detect whether or not there is a so-called high-risk oncogenic type of papillomavirus present. The high-risk oncogenic types are the ones that are associated with the development of precancerous and cancerous changes, whereas the low-risk oncogenic types are associated with warts. So the introduction of the HPV DNA testing for women over age 30 has also been quite beneficial and can allow one, if one has three negative pap smears or negative pap smears in association with negative HPVs, to prolong the interval between testing for cervical precancerous or cancerous changes.
And at what age should a woman start getting pap smears, and how long, say after menopause, does a woman have to continue the pap smears?
Okay. Well, it's just a little bit controversial, but generally speaking, we recommend that within 6 months of a teenager beginning to have sexual intercourse, you should have a pap smear. How long one should continue it has been debated a bit. Between 60 and 65 have been the recommendations of our national organizations like the American Cancer Society. However, we're noticing that a lot more women over age 50 are now being tested positive for HPV. And this group of women in particular has been women who have been divorced or have lost their partner and now have new partners. So while we say 60 to 65, quite honestly, I see no particular upper limit that we should stop doing pap smear screening at this moment.
Peter, maybe you can just take us through a little bit the process of the pap smear. I mean, you know, is there any complications associated? What does it entail? And
well, the pap smear is a very benign test, but it requires that an instrument be inserted into the vagina to expose the cervix so that then one can use what we call a brush and simply wipe the cervix so that cells can slough off the cervix and be captured either in liquid or on a glass slide. And that's the whole process. It's really very simple.
And so it doesn't sound like there are really any significant side effects or complications that can occur from that procedure.
No, but sometimes when one uses a brush on the inside lining of the cervix, you can see some spotting after you have had the pap smear. It's not a reason to be alarmed, but it can occur.
Peter, can you just comment for a woman, like you talked about a woman in the 50s who is now HPV positive, is there any role, say, for a hysterectomy in such a woman to prevent cancer in the future, or is pap smear screening and following the patient adequate to prevent cancer?
Okay, so it gets very confusing about what these abnormal pap smears and these abnormal HPV testings really mean to an individual patient. But in a postmenopausal woman who has a negative pap smear but is HPV positive, meaning that this high-risk oncogenic type, she needs to be followed more carefully than somebody who has a pap smear associated, a normal pap smear, but has no high-risk HPV present. That woman should be still followed on an annual basis. If there's high-risk HPV present, she needs to be colposcoped. And in particular, in postmenopausal women, the area of concern is called the transformation zone. That's an area where the outside surface of the cervix, which is lined by squamous cells, meets the glandular cells of the canal. In the postmenopausal woman, this area recedes into the cervical canal, and the colposcopy doesn't always pick up everything. But if the pap smear is positive, that patient should be colposcoped and biopsied as soon as the report is available.
Peter, maybe you can just clarify one thing. The HPV test, is that a blood test, or is that a test done on the fluid that's that comes out of the pap smear?
Yeah, that the HPV test is a test that's done on the fluid that's associated with the pap smear itself. It's what's in the container when after the doctor has taken the pap smear.
Just curious, is there any kind of blood test that can be done to kind of help in this screening process?
Not currently.
What about prevention programs here in New Haven? The hospital participates in the National Breast and Cervical Cancer Early Detection Program. Can you talk a little bit about this?
Yes, that program was originally started in 1990, and it was more of a screening and early detection program. But in the year 2000, a law was passed allowing not only the provision of pap smears and mammograms for women who are either under a certain income level or are unable to provide any kind of health care. It's a free program, and it allows for both the screening for pap smears and also for mammography. And now, since 2000, through Medicaid, it allows the payment of the services so that people can get can be treated free of charge. It's done through the state of Connecticut. And Yale New Haven Hospital is one of several hospitals in the state where this program is active.
It's great to hear that this is available to women across the state, Peter. We'd like to talk a little bit more in detail after the break about treatment of cervical cancer. You're listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we're here with Dr. Peter Schwartz discussing the risks and the prevention of cervical cancer.
There are over 10 million cancer survivors in the U.S., and the numbers keep growing. Completing cancer treatment is very exciting, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. After treatment, the return to normal activities and relationships can be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, such as the Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and Dr. Peter Schwartz, an expert in gynecologic cancers from the Yale Cancer Center. So, Peter, we talked a lot about the risks for cervical cancer and the role of HPV, but now, if you have a woman who has cervical cancer, what are the treatment options?
Good. So let's define what we mean by cervical cancer, because a lot of people are told they have cervical cancer when actually they have the precancerous change. So for precancerous changes, there are simple procedures one can do in the office or an outpatient surgery center which remove a piece of the cervix. It's called a cone biopsy. It can be done many ways, with a scalpel, with a laser, with a loop, electrolyzed loop. It's called the LEAP procedure. However, when one has invasive cancer of the cervix, then one has to be more aggressive. And so for the early stage cervical cancers, the standard treatment has been an operation called a radical hysterectomy, which not only removes the cervix, but it removes a sort of boundary of normal, border of normal tissue that surrounds the cervix. It also removes the upper vagina. For more advanced disease, radiation in combination with chemotherapy is the standard treatment for the management of cervical cancer.
Is there any role, say, for radiation in some of these patients who just have limited involvement, who don't undergo surgery?
For limited involvement, radiation alone is not generally used. However, there's an operation called a radical trachelectomy and partial vaginectomy, which is being done here at Yale, which is an operation that is designed to hopefully cure cervical cancer and preserve fertility. That operation would be used in a select group of younger aged women.
Now Peter, would a woman typically go to the general GYN physician, or for really these treatments that you're talking about, really that individual should seek medical care from a specialist like yourself, a GYN oncologist?
For the precancerous changes, those changes called cervical intraepithelial neoplasia, our community doctors are trained to take care of this, and that's where the overwhelming majority of patients receive their care, is with the community doctors and our community hospitals. For invasive cancer of the cervix, that's a different situation. That's where they need to see a gynecologic oncologist.
What is the role of CAT scanning, PET scanning, and MRI scanning in women who have invasive cervical cancer in terms of making a diagnosis and treatment planning?
Okay, so making a diagnosis, we diagnose by simply biopsying in the office. That gives us the diagnosis of an invasive cervical cancer. Once we have that diagnosis, then the question is, how far has the disease spread? If in the office, on physical exam by a gynecologic oncologist, the disease seems to be limited to the cervix, we often don't do much more diagnostic evaluation. However, if the disease seems to extend beyond the cervix, then diagnostic imaging is important. The CAT scan can be very helpful in telling us whether or not there's a disease involving lymph nodes, particularly along the periaortic area. It will help us tell whether the urinary tract is in any way involved. We look for the things like ureteral obstruction, deviation, and duplication. The MRI is much more effective in looking directly at the local area in the pelvis to tell us whether the disease has extended outside of the cervix, and can certainly look very well at the pelvic lymph nodes and tell us whether or not there might be involvement. The PET scan is generally used to identify more distant spread. So early stage cervical cancer, very limited imaging is necessary. More advanced stage, that's where these other imaging modalities really come into play, and that's how we use it.
Peter, is there any role for chemotherapy, you know, giving chemotherapy drugs either before surgery is performed or perhaps giving chemotherapy drugs once surgery has been conducted?
Yeah. So giving chemotherapy before definitive surgery is done or radiation is done is called neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and it's something that's been going on for certainly at least the last 25 years in cervical cancer management. And this is particularly because in the third world, they see a lot more advanced stage disease than we see. It appears that neoadjuvant chemotherapy is most effective in something called stage 1B2 cervical cancer. This is when the cancer is really expanding the cervix beyond 4 centimeters, but it hasn't spread outside of that area. And it would appear that neoadjuvant chemotherapy can shrink the cervix down and then allow the surgeons to do radical hysterectomies. So that's the one place where neoadjuvant chemotherapy appears to be effective. Once the diagnosis is made and radiation is going to be given, cisplatinum chemotherapy is usually given as a single agent on a weekly basis. There have been 4 different studies that have shown that for patients receiving primary radiation therapy, platinum-based chemotherapy in combination with radiation is the most effective way to treat people. And then there's been a study that showed for those women who have had radical hysterectomies but have bad prognostic features when the pathologist examines the specimen, those patients who would then get postoperative radiation if one adds chemotherapy also benefit from the combination of the chemotherapy with platinum, cisplatin, and the radiation.
So, Peter, what are the complications for a woman of having a combination of chemotherapy and radiation?
The complications don't seem to be increased significantly. What the issue is with radiation is that it can irritate the bowel and it can irritate the bladder. So typically, patients who receive radiation or chemo radiation tend to have loose stool and diarrhea, which during radiation therapy, the radiotherapist will put them on diets and give them medication to control that. They also will have to pass urine more frequently during the radiation. For the most part, that clears following completion of the chemo radiation.
What about the role of biological agents? We've heard a lot about HER2 new antibodies in breast cancer and the antibodies that are targeting the EGF receptor in various kinds of solid tumors. Do any of those apply to the treatment of cervical cancer?
At this moment, there, to my knowledge, are none approved. However, there is a research program that is being conducted by the Gynecologic Oncology Group, which is now an international study group, but it's really based in the United States. And we are participants in the GOG study, and we are looking at EGFR, epidermal growth factor receptor inhibitors, in recurrent cervical cancer. So it's still experimental at this point.
Peter, how significant a problem is recurrence of cervical cancer?
Well, it's a real problem. Basically, in Connecticut, we see 2 groups of women. One who have had fairly reasonable pap smear screening surveillance, and they tend to be found with early stage cervical cancer, usually cured with a radical hysterectomy. And then we get another group, and that's the larger group. Those are women who have declined having pap smear screening. They come in with invasive disease that's advanced. Early stage disease, stage 1 disease, has roughly a 90% cure rate. Once we start to see the disease has spread outside of the uterus, the cure rates decline dramatically, so that when it's spread just limited outside the pelvis, stage 2B has about a 60% cure rate. When it's spread to the pelvic sidewalls, stage 3B, then we're talking about between a 30 and a 50% cure rate, which means that 50 to 70% of the patients are going to recur. And with stage 4 disease, which we still see in Connecticut in women who have neglected to have pap smears, almost every one of them is going to recur.
When we talk about neglecting to have pap smears, we probably should have talked about this this at the beginning, but are there any symptoms that those women would have experienced? So if you just go on without a pap smear and you're developing cervical cancer, how would you know?
Okay. That's a great question. Typically, the belief by gynecologists was that women with invasive cancer have symptoms. Women with pre-invasive disease don't have symptoms. The women with invasive disease experience bleeding because the tumor grows and outstretches its blood supply, and they tend to bleed. They can have vaginal discharge, and this is due to secondary infection by the bacteria in the vagina that causes malodorous discharge, and they can have pain as the tumor invades the nerves in the pelvic sidewall. That pain can radiate down their legs. Sciatic pain is very classic for advanced stage cervical cancer. We did a study, however, looking at precancerous changes in the cervix and early cervical cancer, and we found about the same proportion of our patients had bleeding spontaneously or after sex who had carcinoma in situ, the precancerous change that's one step before invasive cancer. So abnormal vaginal bleeding, particularly bleeding after having intercourse, is a very, very serious warning that there could be a problem of cervical cancer or precancerous change.
And Peter, what percentage of women, say, in the state of Connecticut in the United States, still are not getting screened for cervical cancer?
Yeah. Well, back in the 1980s, we reported on women who had cervical cancer who had been getting annual pap smears, and we called it a rapidly invasive cervical cancer. And that led to a very large program project that where we looked at every case of cervical cancer in Connecticut between 1985 and 1990. And what we found was that the invasive cancers, about 25% occurred in women who had pap smears that were red as normal within 3 years of the diagnosis of cancer. 75% either had not had pap smears or had stopped having pap smears once they had delivered their last child. So we found that a large percent of the patients who developed the cancer don't have pap smears. What we don't know is overall how many women don't have pap smears.
Now, do you have a sense in 2009, have we gotten better in terms of kind of bringing down that number from 75% to hopefully a much lower number?
I don't have a feeling that it's changed very much, to tell you the truth. When I look at what goes on in our service, I really think that this is the best reason for Gardasil, for the cervical vaccine.
Peter, in terms of understanding the biology of these kinds of cancers, GYN cancers, I understand that you have a very active research program in your department called the Discovery to Cure. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the Discovery Cure program, it's about 10 years old now, I suspect. It was originally designed to study ovarian cancer. Then we moved into uterine cancer, and now that Dr. Alessandro Santin has joined the faculty, Dr. Santin is, among many things, he's interested in vaccine therapy for cervical cancer, and he is in a phase two trial now looking at a vaccine that he has developed for cervical cancer. So the Discovery to Cure program is marching on, and we're taking on more and more disease as we are able to afford investigators and laboratory research.
And are there any clinical trials that you and your colleagues are currently involved with focusing on developing new therapies for, say, advanced recurrent cervical cancer?
At this moment, we have one, the only one that we're actively involved with is the gynecologic oncology group trial that uses molecularly targeted therapy, and Dr. Santin is the principal investigator for the gynecologic oncology group in that trial.
And great. Peter, I guess as we get close to summer, I just wanted to put in a plug for your program, because I know that you do take on high school students to work in the research labs along with senior investigators, and that is a tremendous program, hopefully to interest some young people in going into science in the future.
Exactly right. It's a great program. Dr. Gil Moore runs that program now for us. We support it through the Discovery to Cure mechanism. And it's just one of the things. We not only are interested in laboratory research, we're interested in education. And it starts in the high school. We have college students as well working in the lab, medical students, and we have graduate students as well in those labs. So it's a lot of information that we try to provide to a lot of different people.
Great. Well, it's amazing how quickly the time has gone. And Peter, we look forward to having you back in a future show to give us an update on what's going on with cervical cancer and all of the other GYN cancers that you're involved in.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
You've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our special guest expert, Dr. Peter Schwartz, for joining us this evening. Until next time, I'm Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center, wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have questions or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.